Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Dashable, an app to help you find deals, discounts, and coupons for local businesses in New York City.
HRN is offering complimentary business memberships to 50 Black, Indigenous, people of color-owned food businesses this summer. The deadline to apply is July 31st. Each business membership, a $500 value, is an advertising opportunity that will allow businesses disproportionately impacted by COVID-19 to connect with HRN's listening community and promote their work. To apply and review the terms and conditions, go to heritageradionetwork.org/biz.
Cooking issues! Go!
Hello and welcome to Cooking Issues. This is Dave Arnold, your host of Cooking Issues, coming to you live on the Heritage Radio Network every Tuesday from whenever to whenever. I'm doing from the Lower East Side here in Manhattan, as is our special guest, who I'll introduce in a minute. We have, as usual, Nastasia the Hammer Lopez calling in from Stamford, Connecticut on the sound. How you doing, Stas?
Good.
We got Matt in the booth. What's going on?
That one was for you, Stas.
Well, we'll get to that in a minute. How you doing, Matt?
I'm doing great.
We got John from Murray Hill, Hill. How you doing?
I'm doing well, thank you.
Yeah. And that intro was done years ago. Now, that is not the style of music that Nastasia grooves on, true or false?
I hate that music. I think it's not cool.
Okay.
It's not cool.
Okay. That was by longtime listener, friend of the show, and someone I know in the real life, Joel Gargano, who has an amazing restaurant called Grano Arso in Chester, Connecticut. They are, I don't know if they're open yet for any inside business, but
they have an
outdoor business and a takeaway business. And if you like food that tastes good, I suggest going to his restaurant when you are in Chester. And in fact, we don't have it queued up, but there is a Cooking Issues related jingle about it. Yes.
I'm sure the food is cool.
The food is cool, yes. And I think they... John, you independently verify this. You've been to his restaurant.
Yeah, he makes some of my favorite pasta out there. His food is really delicious. Yeah. Really, really love it, yeah.
Now, I have another friend of mine who is our special guest for today, who is also on a Zoom call, but I can almost throw a rock and hit him if I could throw a rock that high, because he lives in the same sort of co-op-y units. The buildings he used to live in, that he lives in, used to be the exact same co-op as the one I'm in. There was a major fight like 15 years ago. Well, John DeBerry, friend of the show, friend in the real life, John DeBerry. How you doing, John?
Pretty good. I could talk about the balkanization of the East River Housing co-op an entire show, but I don't know if that's necessary.
Well, give me so it's a classic New York scenario. What they did was there was a bunch of what they considered undesirable tenement style housing in the Lower East Side between the water, which is the East River here, and Essex Street, that they just annihilated. They just freaking, like, this is what they used to do, and probably what they still do, is like, hey, there's a problem with this area, why don't we kick everybody out and annihilate it? So they did that, and then built up a series of co-op buildings, which at the time were, they're co-ops, so you own them, but they were paid for with government money, so they were intended for kind of, they weren't fancy. Called Mitchell Lama houses, and they extended from like Essex Street to the water, which is like a 15-minute walk, John, total. So it's big.
Yeah,
it's extensive. And they were all the same kind of, owned by the same kind of co-op group. And then there was a fight. You want to discuss the fight, or you just want to, like, you want to leave it there?
Well, I actually don't know a ton about the fight, but basically it was started by, you know, this, you know, Amalgamated Bank. It's the same group of people. It's basically like Jewish factory workers in the 50s got together and created like a co-op place to live. And
yeah,
there's
the
like
the Women's Garment Workers Union, right?
Yeah. And then there's like, so there's like Amalgamated is the name of one of the subunits. And there's Hillman, and Hillman's the guy who started Amalgamated. And then there's Seward Park. And then we're in East River. And then Seward Park broke off. And I have to say they're a little bit nicer, so I think they probably got the better end of that deal.
Well, actually, I think your
a lot of board drama.
Your landscaping is nicer, and you
have a whole
you have the better
park.
Water views.
Yeah, and you have all the, you have all that like playground bull. We have like nothing. I mean, it's nice, but it's not. Yeah. It's no Seward Park.
The original fight was because it used to be that houses here cost or co-ops apartments cost almost nothing, literally like $20,000. And but you couldn't just sell your co-op to somebody else. It would like go back into the co-op. So the people who were on the board used to do all this incredibly shady dealing, mm-hmm. where they would like deal to themselves and their family, and they would build up these mega apartments where they would almost like gerbils, like bust their way through apartments and like up and down and get all the plum stuff. So there was a lot of unrest, shall we say. And then there was like dealing about who was going to run the power. So they broke apart. Anyway, so John and I are not in the same apartments, but they're kind of the same apartments. It's like we was brothers. You know what I mean?
Yeah. I think I can see your building from my window.
Yeah, I can't.
But you're on the other side.
I'm way down low. Hey, listen, for those of you
I can keep tabs on you.
Right. Which is smart. For those of you who are crazy enough during the COVID to want to move into New York City, let me give you this piece of advice. You either want to be high enough up to get the good views, or you want to be low enough such that you can see trees, but not so low that people are knocking on your window. So that should be you should be looking at floors 3 and 4 or high enough to get a good view. That is my little bit of advice to you. And, you know, Nastasia only wants you to look on the west side of Manhattan, not down where we live, because she believes the sun is nicer over there.
But it's not true. Well, the sun is nice everywhere.
But you're a west side girl, true?
Yeah, I like the west side. Yeah.
You lived on the east side for what, about 20, 30 minutes before you were like, I got to get out of here?
No, in college I lived in Midtown East.
And what do you think?
It was nice. It was great. I liked it.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Anyway, I've only known you to live over in the Hell's Kitchen area. That seems to be, if I had to pick a Nastasia neighborhood, that would be it. I think if you had like boatloads of cash such that you were like, you know, rafting around in your money pile, would that be the neighborhood you would choose to live in if you were going to live in New York?
No, Central Park, because you'll never have construction in front of you.
Oh, yeah?
That's smart.
West Park.
Anything below 60th, east, west, south.
Would you want
below
like one of those
60th?
No, you mean basically on 59th Street then? You mean on 59th Street?
below 72nd. Yeah, I guess. Yeah, okay. Below
65th. That's so weird.
Basically, I'll only live on Central Park South. But we're talking, Rebecca. Yeah. Oh, yeah, we have Rebecca, the boondoggler, also on the air. Forgot to call. Where are you calling in from?
I'm calling in from my home. Dave, where do I live? I'm just curious if you know.
You live somewhere in Brooklyn, but I've never been to your house, so I have no idea where it is.
It's true. I'm basically right near the Brooklyn Museum. So.
Okay. Wait, you know. The Brooklyn, the one that's right next to the Botanical Gardens?
Yes.
That's a great museum. Can I just say that, like, when they open again, if you have not been to the Brooklyn, what's it actually called? Does anyone know the Brooklyn Art Museum? What's it called?
The Brooklyn Museum.
Brooklyn Museum?
Yeah.
Fantastic museum. Like, I was like, well, I live in Manhattan. I've got all the museums. I got all the good stuff. Brooklyn Museum, worth a visit.
Also, the Botanic Gardens are amazing.
Okay, listen. I like the Brooklyn Botanic Gardens. It is, I have Nastasia. That is where Nastasia perpetrated the Santa Claus atrocity. So ooh. I have a love in my heart for it for that reason. I'm now like all I'm picturing is Nastasia, like, bent over double, laughing her behind off, while Santa is bathed in his own puke, dancing on the ground.
And you and Jack went and hid behind the bar. Like, that was very cowardly.
Excuse you.
It wasn't just Nastasia. It was me, too.
Were you also bent over double laughing?
Probably.
And that was also hilarious. That was also the day when we punked Heritage Radio. That was the best.
Yes. Yes.
So for those of you, we didn't tell this on last week's show, but Nastasia and I were like, the Heritage kept on calling and pestering us about when we were going to show up and make our cocktails. We were doing a frozen drink machine at the time. We were making frozen Corsairs, which is a preserved lemon drink. And Nastasia sends, we were talking about it. It wasn't that she was doing this on her own. So I'm not trying to say that she's a bad person. We were both doing it, right? But she sends a text to Heritage basically saying, so like what time tomorrow is, it was the day of the event. What time tomorrow is load in, right? So and we're going to go non-family for just 1 second, right? We're going to go non-family.
Yeah, remove your children if they're listening for at least 30
earmuffs,
seconds.
Yeah, earmuffs, as Vaughn would say. So Nastasia goes at, and then they write back, it's today, it's right now. And she goes, oh, sends that text, oh, and that was it.
You guys are horrible. But question for you, Dave, why do you think that Heritage was checking in on you? Like, why do you think they felt the need to see if you were going to be there?
Hey, Nastasia.
Micromanagers.
Nastasia.
Yes.
In your whole life,
yes.
In your whole life, how many times when you said you're going to do something, have you not done it?
Always.
No, I mean, like, you've never not done it. Right?
Keeping that there's nothing you can say now. That's the end of the show.
Backwards.
Yeah. You always do what you're going to say. Likewise, like, if I say I'm going to do a demo or something like that, do I do it?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, but you might be late, but you'll do it. I think it was more about like the timing in general, you know. But I will say though that that was an incredible party, and the fact that one Santa got relegated to the end of it because he was spewing red wine on himself was pretty much the highlight of the party for me. And Matt, I know I saw you the next day, right? Because I came back to pick up Wine Santa, and
we got to carry it out together.
It was a whole thing.
I think I had his head and you had the rest of him, or the other way around. I can't recall.
Yep. Sounds about right.
It was fun. There were some horrified children in the Botanic Garden being like, is happening?
So we got on this because we're talking about the Botanic Garden, and I was just going to say I'm more of a New York Botanic Garden Bronx fellow myself, but I do like the Brooklyn Botanic Garden. But going back to what you just said, that Wine Santa was puking up wine all over himself, and then we switched him to vodka. Now, John DeBerry has just written a book called Drink What You Want, which is one of the reasons he's on the show today.
It's an amazing book.
And so is that a valid thing to want, to be throwing up red wine over yourself, boot and rally, and go on to straight vodka, or not a valid thing in the context of Drink What You Want? I'm presuming that is not the meaning of the book, so why don't you tell us a little bit about the book?
Well, I mean, I guess the meaning of the book is, like, if it works for you, then good for you. So if that's the transition you want to make, you know, I'm not here to judge you too much. But yeah, the point of the book was to really kind of democratize or sort of like break down what makes drinks good on a few different kind of axes or, you know, ways of measuring. And then show people that the reason why a lot of drinks succeed or fail is sort of based on the same principles, and whether or not you're doing something, you know, super elaborate, like with, like, let's say a rotovap or something like that, you know, or you're just throwing something together with what you have on hand, like, you're kind of still using the basic principles and the skills are kind of the same. So you don't have to worry too much about, like, doing something necessarily wrong because you don't have the right setup. It's more about, well, you're using the tools you have and you're finding drinks that taste good, given what you're able to do at the time. So it's kind of like, it's this sort of like, after being regurgitated through like the high end bar and restaurant world for 10 years, I like came out of it on the other side being like, actually things are really a lot more similar than they are different. And you know, here's how you know, here's why the daiquiri is, you know, the kind of primordial sour, and you can riff all these drinks on it, but they all kind of work in the same way. And here's how to sort of like demystify a lot of this stuff. Cause I think that like a lot of people tend to feel like if they're not an expert at drink making, then they're just like completely hopeless and they shouldn't even try, you know? So it's trying to get to the point where people are really just comfortable. Cause it's kind of like basically f-ing around in their own, the comfort of their own environment. And then saying you can build on that if you, you know, if you want to get fancier or more elaborate.
Right. So you start with a, you start fun. So first of all, let's talk about the.
Wait, are we not doing a family show or what?
Yeah, we are. He slipped. Come on, Seth. I mean, yes.
Oh,
who did the illustrations for this book, by the way?
Her name is Sarah Tennant Jones. She's the artist based in the UK. And I feel really lucky that my publisher found her, because I think she like weirdly nailed my personality based on like not a whole ton. Like she started working on the illustrations like before the manuscript was finished. So it was kind of like this parallel process. And like, I don't think we even spoke on the phone. You know, we like sent a lot of emails back and forth and like shot lists and sort of like basic ideas. And I think she mined my Instagram pretty nicely as well. And then just like this, the whole kind of sort of sketchy, but sharp, kind of personality of the book. It was really just captured really, really expertly. And I knew I didn't want, photos, because I did enough cocktail photo shoots that I have like a pretty, pretty good PTSD from how long that takes and how expensive they are, and how it's really only, to me, it's a lot about the glassware than the drink itself. So I'd rather just have more fun with it and kind of have a more presentational depiction of drinks to show like, okay, well, you could do this, but if it doesn't look exactly like this, it's not wrong. Like you're still going to have a good time if it works for you. So I was really adamant about illustrations, and originally I wanted to do kind of like a comic book thing, but that was like way too elaborate. So we've kind of like settled on this, and I couldn't be happier.
So for those of you that don't know, that have never had to do it, like shooting endless amounts of cocktails for a book is completely soul crushing. It's like,
it's the actual worst. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, so, I know, you know, our, you know, mutual friend, partner, Don Lee, had to do a bunch of that, cause he worked on with Jim on Meehan, who wrote the foreword for this book, on one of those things. But it's just like making everything look different or interesting in the context of a book where you're doing a bazillion cocktails. It's just like, what are we going to do with this one?
Right.
I mean, you know what I mean? It's just like it's the opposite of like coming up with like an interesting new cocktail recipe or a twist on a cocktail where you can feel interested in what you're doing. Like being forced to make something look, especially for someone like me anyway, where like I don't do garnish.
Like, yeah, same. I was like, all these drinks are so simple. Like you're just going to list. It's basically just pictures of glassware.
Yeah. Yeah.
So
it's a complete nightmare.
Which, yeah, it's a nightmare.
So, but like I didn't actually... I should have known this, I guess, but like I didn't know that you were kind of into the kind of 50s, 60s vibe. Because it's interesting because the illustrations, and John, you commented on how much you like the illustrations, right?
Yep. Very big.
It's
very
got
nice.
This like 50s, 60s, like specific Americana vibe, but then obviously the cocktails could be part of that. But then, you know, the illustration of you on page 132, and God, I hope you own that outfit, right, where you're like some sort of like party vampire,
mm-hmm. More or less.
Shoes. Do you own that outfit? Because that wouldn't be in that normal 50s, 60s book, and I want to see you in that outfit at all times. Like, which aspects of that outfit do you own? Do you own the lucite cane?
Oh, I wish, man. The cane would be great. No, I only. What do I have that's lucite? Nothing. Shopping list. The funny thing is that a lot of that stuff was just with Sarah. Like we didn't give her a ton of guidance on the feeling, you know, depictions of me, you know, like feeling, I think that's feeling fancy, and then there's desperate and, you know, festive and all this stuff. And really it was just like, you know, this is the basic idea. We want a picture of me doing something that represents the mood of each chapter, you know? And I think we probably, at least I didn't give her a ton of like direct, like explicit guidance. Like, oh, I want you to depict me in like these clothes or like, you know, this, you know, pit position or anything. It was just, you know, I just really, I feel like it just came down a lot to this, the chemistry between the two of us in terms of just like, she understood what I was doing without having to be given a lot of like really explicit instructions. I mean, I'm sure there was a lot between her and the art director in the book, but it just felt very natural. Like, and if you look at her past work, it's all has this really nice, like you said, the kind of mod 50s sort of feeling to it, but it's sort of timeless, but also calls to like, it feels very specific, but it doesn't feel like dated or like kind of periody.
So you're telling me you don't own the Fred McMurray My Three Sons shoes on page 102, and you don't own that easy chair? I want you to own that easy chair, because it's in the Feeling Classics. It's in the classic cocktail section. There's a picture of John DeBerry in white bow tie. By the way, for those of you that know John,
probably have
John,
a white bow tie, yeah.
A demure JDB. You check out his Instagram. You see what I'm saying? That is a very demure JDB. In like, I mean, I would have that. I mean, it wouldn't really fit, you know, my wife being a kind of more modern architect, that chair wouldn't fit in with her aesthetic, but I would sit in that chair. I want you to have that chair and those shoes, you know, anyway. Wait, one last thing I have to ask about the pictures. Does that mean, so John writes about glassware and he includes a section on coffee mugs just so that he can say that he wishes that you would throw away your mismatched coffee mugs and get matching coffee mugs. Or not throw them away, but then he has two mismatched mugs. Oh no, those are the tiki glass sections. Those aren't mugs. Because I thought of that octopus as a mug, and I want that octopus glass real bad. Do you own that octopus glass?
No, I don't. The thing with the tiki mugs is that I find like the kind of like Cucamonga like tribal imagery to be a bit racist. So I was like telling her, I'm like, these are tiki mugs, but please don't use any tribal stuff. Like, try to use like other imagery, like. I couldn't use Star Wars, obviously, but I do have Star Wars tiki mugs. And I just tried to find a bunch of tiki mugs that didn't have this sort of like tribal mask or Easter Island or any of that kind of like stuff that I think is a little kind of dated for a lot of reasons. But, you know, I think that the coffee mug bit was sort of like, I don't know if you had experienced this as writing, but like a lot of times if you just sort of write and you don't really realize what it is you want to write until you're like done writing it. And I just sort of started writing about coffee mugs and then I just kind of like blacked out. And then I was just kind of like, who has matching coffee mugs? Like, what kind of like deranged energy do you need to like not, you know, like everyone just sort of accumulates them and it's kind of like, oh, I have like one mug from like a newspaper from like 1990. And then like they sort of accumulate these random one-offs. But like no one else does that for any other kind of glassware. So I just thought that was a really interesting phenomenon and basically just an excuse to write a stupid joke in the book.
Do you have a set of matching world's best bartender mugs? That would be amazing.
Yeah, I do.
Yeah.
Definitely.
Now, before we get into too much, like one of your most famous drinks, which I think they still serve at PDT if you ask it. So you have a tiki mug illustration here of a shark, and I'm looking at this mug, and it would be physically impossible to drink out of it. So I'm assuming that is just there as a teaser for your drink, the shark. You want to talk about this drink?
Yeah. The shark is, I think, it's actually, even though PDT is like basically just doing to-go, they actually have it in a little to-go version, so you can still get it, even though, you know, their menu is down to like four drinks. So I feel very validated in that. And I came up with that like a really long time ago, back when, I don't know, probably like 2012. And I think everyone was very serious about cocktails. And the idea of even like having blue curacao like in the premises of a bar was like kind of heretical. And I think that we actually had a bottle of blue curacao like by accident, like it wasn't like an authorized purchase. So I was just kind of looking for ways to like do something stupid, and I kind of started with the shark is like butter infused rum and like cream frangelico and like blue curacao. So it's just kind of this like abomination of a drink that doesn't make sense with any of the kind of fancy sort of like ornate and the kind of precious drinks that you find at a lot of cocktail bars. And it was sort of a one-off, like not one-off, but it was sort of like a flame war with Jim Meehan, because I was kind of like, well, how far can I push this? Like, how far can I make this drink as ridiculous as possible? And it just kind of like spiraled out of control from there. And then we ended up with the blue drink with cream on the menu. That's been there for probably 8 years now.
Yeah. Well, whenever I go, like someone I'm with invariably, because I have a well-known hatred for blue curacao, not mainly stemming from the fact that I think you should just add blue food coloring to the drink if you want to use blue, right? That's my main.
I mean, it's the same thing.
Well, but you would never choose. You would never choose that spirit, right?
To make blue.
Right. You would choose like whatever your actual favorite orange liqueur is, and then just put a few drops of blue in it, right? And I always, my gripe, and I should just say it, like my gripe has always been that, like, it's not the blueness that bothers me or the fact that it's fake. I just prefer more honesty in the fakeness. Now, where you're coming from is an entirely different place. It's an F you on being precious about it, which I get. And they're, and like, to be honest, in the bar world, and you can do it. You can do all of the spirit nerdery, right? So I feel, I guess at a certain point you feel that you've earned the right to do whatever you want. You don't have to be full spirit nerd. You can be a little more fun, a little more like playful.
Mm-hmm.
But like, I don't have this spirit nerdery that a lot of people have, like this producer, that producer. I haven't spent my time, you know, traveling the world, going to different distilleries to visit all the different places. Like that's because that's just not my wheelhouse. I've never had to, because I never really worked behind the stick on the regular. I've never had to have those kinds of discussions with patrons, because if you're not a spirit nerd in a high-end cocktail bar, patrons will rip you a new one. They'll try to sniff out your lack of knowledge in any one little category. Am I right about this?
Sometimes, yeah. There's a particular kind of person who gets pleasure from doing that.
Right, right. So like, kind of, I had this place where I didn't need to be able to kind of cut loose and say I'm going to make something delicious with this ingredient that you hate. For me, it's more like, well, I would never choose that spirit other than for the blue. And so, like, I would rather just use blue. So that's where I'm coming from on it. You know what I mean? So it's not.
But that's it. I think that the Senor Curacao, which this isn't sponsored or anything like that, but like the brand that we used originally, I think it's probably still the same. I think it actually tastes really good. Like, it's actually a very good, like, Curacao, like, liqueur. And then it just happens to be blue. Huh.
Well, that's good to know. Senor Curacao, go try it out. The other thing is also this I've noticed, and things that taste the best on their own are not necessarily the things that taste best in a mélange. You know what I'm saying? So, and this has happened to us time and again when you're doing recipe testing. This goes for cooking and for drinks, by the way, is that you'll test a recipe with whatever you have on hand, and then you'll be like, well, now I'm going to go buy the good stuff, thinking that that is inherently going to make your product better. Not necessarily the case.
Yeah, things can definitely be less than some of their parts.
Yeah, yeah. And things that taste bad on their own can make things taste good in the levels and concentrations that you're using them. I definitely learned that doing, you know, all of my distillation work back in the day. Stas, I've never asked you, what's your opinion on blue drinks?
I like the one Nick Bennett serves.
Yeah, what's that one called? So Nick Bennett was the head bartender at Booker & Dax, where there was a strict no blue rule, right? Although now we have, well, now, when we reopen in the real life, like, we'll, you know, we have a couple of, but we just add food coloring to it. But what's the name of Nick's drink over there at Porchlight, the blue one? I can't remember the name of it.
I can't remember.
It's something, I feel like it's something
I'm
nautical.
I'm looking it up right now. Yeah, it's so good.
Yeah. Yeah. Like I said, it's like, for me, I don't use it for my own reasons. And I, you know, I don't know if you remember, John, you were in the audience, but when we saw the Cocktail Kingdom put on the Japanese bartender series. And you know, you're, for those of you that don't know, you spent how long living in Japan? Like a year or something like this?
Oh, no, not that long. I mean, I spent about the max amount that you could spend on a tourist visa there, which is about 90 days.
Oh, yeah. But you speak.
But yeah, I mean, I studied Japanese history in college, so I had to take a lot of the language course for the major. So yeah.
Were you part of that, like, I want to say, like, 2012, or was that, I think that's around when it was, right? 2012, like, Japanese cocktail wave that was hitting the US, or no?
Yeah, you know, I did that there. I think that's the course. I think maybe we were both in. I think Lynette was in it. It was like a whole, like, Japanese bartending course, taught by this like Romanian guy. I don't know who's. I forget.
Oh,
no.
I didn't go to that, but that was the. Yeah. I remember what you're talking about. Stanislaus.
Yes.
So he did a Tales of the Cocktail, a Japanese. So, okay. Ancient history, I know, but I'll give you a little bit. So everyone in the cocktail world was trying to figure out like what their kind of mystic connection to the drink was going to be, such that their combination of three ingredients served in a glass was going to be somehow magically and mystically better than your mixture of three ingredients put into a glass and served was going to be. Would you say it's an accurate portrayal?
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a lot of sort of like storytelling and myth making involved in like the craft cocktail revival, if you will, of the last decade, which is fine.
Wait, it's okay.
Yeah.
Because like, you know, a good myth, like literally can make someone enjoy the drink more.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Right. And so anything you do, whether it's a story, myth, like the truth and false, you know, the falsity of it isn't really the important thing. It's the enjoyment that the guest has. So I'm okay with it. I'm okay with stories. But there was a story around kind of this, and it's not really the fault of the bartenders that they were highlighting, right? That, for instance, the hard shake or these very specific Japanese styles, which were built around a very specific set of kind of cultural, like, a cultural system in Japan for how those bars came to be the way they are, how the apprentice system works in Japan, you know, how everything works over there has generated this stuff that to an American or a European is in some ways like very attractive, right? Very, like, you know, like extremely, what's the word? I can't come to the word I'm looking for, but like compelling, right? And so it kind of hit the world by storm, and there was a group of Americans and Europeans who were like, I've tapped into the mysticism of the cocktail, and they were doing this kind of work. And so, you know, you're an interesting case because you're not like that, right? But you were also like literally tuned in, i.e. you could speak and you'd been over there and done this stuff, to kind of what they were talking about. So, I mean, what do you think about how that kind of shook down?
Yeah, I mean, I think that there's like a it's a little bit problematic in terms of just like an American person like goes to Japan for a week and then tries to teach people the hard shake. I think that's the case with kind of any, you know, body of knowledge. Like a lot of people get an exposure to it and they think they know a lot about it. And then they go and like kind of try to claim it as their own. And that just sort of makes you look foolish and can be harmful in many contexts. So for me, it's like, I knew enough to know that this was way more than I was willing to get myself involved in. And in order to claim any kind of expertise or sort of any kind of like authority over this, it would be a lot more work than I was willing to put in. Just knowing what I know about Japanese culture, you know, my limited amount of awareness, like I knew it's not something you could take like a seminar, like a weekly seminar, and just all of a sudden be able to be teaching other people how to do it or to even claim that you know how to do it. So for me, I was just like, that's a no for me. Like this is cool to watch. Like it's interesting to hear about. I don't believe a lot of this stuff. I feel like a lot of this stuff is like, gets like sort of telephone gamed out of like the real authentic sources, and then people start repeating it, and then it becomes this weird like bastardized lore about like ice chips and air bubbles and, you know, all these sort of silly things that can get really kind of more about the bartender than the person who's drinking, which goes back to like the kind of storytelling thing where it's like, yes, you want to be like tell a compelling story with something you're serving as a bartender, but also if it's just about you showing off, then that's like really the opposite of hospitality. So I just knew that it was just, I was just never going to get there. So I just didn't even bother. But I appreciate it. And I think it's cool and I love it, but I'm not going to tell people how to do a hard shake. And I can never get those Parisian shakers open anyway. So that was also just big disqualifying for me on a practical standpoint.
Well, when they were doing their demos here, right. So Parisian are the weird ones that like mesh in a way that doesn't seem like it's going to be physically possible for those to go look it up. It's a thing. And the cobbler's also like, you know, and any American's going to want to be able to do two and a half drinks per run. Cause that's just the way we operate. You know what I mean? So like those cobbler shakers and the giant cobbler shakers, have you ever had one that doesn't leak?
No.
Yeah. So the first one I ever saw, Plymouth Gin, back when Simon Ford was running Plymouth Gin, made these giant shakers. I don't even know how much they hold, but like, you know, like
quartz. Oh, I used those at Sambar. Yeah, I made like probably 10 drinks at once in one of those things. Yeah.
And they are impressive. Free. They leak like a mother. You know what I mean? There's just, they leak. Anyway. Anyhow. All right. So now an interesting thing here that it's kind of like the book we're talking about now again, Drink What You Want, is you're trying to kind of make people feel like a little bit less nervous about doing things. And I think there's something that you touch on that I think would be very useful for a lot of our listeners. A lot of the kind of questions that we get on the people who kind of call in or that I talk to kind of off air, you know, like it seems that there's people who are like very well versed in technique or in spirits lore or in spirits or food lore. But then when they have to go do something outside of what would be their normal comfort zone, they get very nervous. And so this idea of going to like a relative's house or an in-law's house and having to make something from whatever they have can be kind of nerve-wracking, right? Yeah. Because you don't want to insult them by saying, I can't work with your filth. You know what I mean? But on the other hand, you want to do something that is good. So this is something you address. You want to talk about it?
Well, yeah, I mean, I think that you have to sort of, I mean, I think that there's like a element of like knowing your own limitations too when you do things. And with like, I think you're referring to like my in-laws flowchart, which sort of like is a nice way of like looking at how I think in terms of like backup plans and like catastrophic anxiety fantasies. But like, you know, if you're in a place where you think you can pull something off, like a drink, you know, if you're like rummaging through someone's house or if you're like at the beach or if you're in these places where you just don't have everything at your fingertips and you want to do something with what you have rather than planning and going shopping and all that. It's sort of about managing expectations and, you know, you're not going to make, you know, like a perfect Ramos Gin Fizz or something super elaborate with, you know, whatever you have on hand. But if you sort of set yourself up to be okay with like surprising yourself and sort of like being cool with like having things rough around the edges or even just be having it be a total failure. I mean, there's like so many times I've thought I made an amazing drink and it tasted like and you're just like, well, you know, you're not really risking a whole lot. So, you know, the idea that you're going to like you're probably not going to create anything that's going to explode. You're not going to kill anybody probably. So like, you know, just like try it out and here are some principles that you can apply across many different kinds of scenarios, like you know, balance, like dilution, like temperature. Like if you can kind of achieve these goals in terms of like getting your drink cold enough or mixing it with enough water or aerating it in the case of a certain drinks, like you can kind of use your ingenuity and use like your knowledge of like the end point rather than getting too hung up on like, oh, I don't have the shaker or I don't have the right bar spoon. Or, oh, should I have like gin instead of vodka? Like you can sort of see through the kind of immediate limitations and kind of get to this endpoint. And it's a little bit more kind of liberating. And it just makes it more fun, I think.
Do you think it's hard maybe though, sometimes for people to give themselves permission to be liberated, right? So like, for instance, like for us, like if you go somewhere and you're like, oh, big cocktail person, make a cocktail. Oh, you know, you're like, oh, geez. You know what I mean? It's like, and then you got to deal with
it. I think of that. See, that's like a verbatim quote from people.
Yeah. I mean, it happens. And then so like, right. And this is going to happen to a lot of people, I think, who, you know, are listening, is when they go to somebody's house, right? They are going to be the person, ooh, foodie, drink person, blah, blah. And then you're like, and then if you don't give something that knocks their socks off,
you're a dick. Yeah.
Right. And so like, I think like I think, you know, it's hard to give yourself permission to F up.
Right.
But I think it's kind of necessary for your own sanity and also to do a good job with what you have on hand.
Yeah. And I think it also has to do with like the way that the craft of bartending has been sort of perceived over the years. And, you know, if you heard someone read a cookbook and they came over to your house, you wouldn't be like, ooh, like make me a baked Alaska. And then like, look at them funny when they didn't do it. You know, you understand that there's like a lot of preparation and expertise that goes into it. But I think people don't have a lot of the same background in terms of cocktails. So they're like, oh, well, you know, you're just a bartender. You just like throw them in together, like whatever, that's it. And it looks easy, or you don't understand kind of the expertise or complexity that goes into it. And so you think it's just this thing that you can just kind of do wherever, which is true to a certain extent, the same way you can like make a sandwich in a lot of places that aren't a professional kitchen. But I think it sort of has to do with like this kind of catch up that the public is playing with like actually the skill and the expertise and the kind of like lots of hard work that goes into making like really excellent cocktails look very easy when you go into like a cocktail bar and some bartender just, you know, just 2 seconds throws together something that's, that probably took like, you know, who knows, like a week of preparation in the back and downstairs, bar backs, et cetera. But you just don't see that. So I think people have this kind of warped view about like what it takes to make a drink. And I think I had that too. Like I talk about it in the book where I thought I knew everything. And so I would just go to a friend's house and be like, oh, let me make you something. And I'm like, I don't even have a shaker. I don't even have like simple syrup. You know, so you have to like kind of catch up with your own, like what you don't know about what you know. So I think that we're kind of in that still, where it's either, it seems like, really, they're really inaccessible or like really simple and easy, and there isn't a lot of like middle ground and like nuance.
John, can we talk about my favorite part of your book? If you don't
the whole thing.
A cocktail shaker, well, the whole thing, but the alternative for a cocktail shaker. That's your favorite?
Yes. Well, I don't go into this in like super detail in the book. I talk about it a little bit. But, you know, if you think about what a cocktail, like what you're trying to achieve by shaking a drink, you want to get it cold, you want to get it diluted, and you want to get it aerated. So you want to like shake it around with something that will whip air into it. You know, whether that's a Booker Index cocktail cube or some ice or whatever, like a rock, you know, you can kind of get creative. And so there's a lot of things in your kitchen that are like sealable containers that you can hold in your hand. So for me, the trusty quart container that is like the backbone of every restaurant, along with Cambros that are usually, they're very large Cambros, but you have like small square containers that everyone kind of uses in restaurants, but you don't see them a lot in homes. And yeah, you basically any Tupperware you can like. I mean, just thinking off the top of my head, like you could even use like a Ziploc bag if you're like really desperate. Like, there's a lot of ways around it. But to me, the 4-quart Cambro, the 2-quart Cambro, and the quart deli container are like, they're high up there.
Just make sure you hold that lid down, dude. Just make sure you hold it.
Well, if it's a fresh Cambro, it's nice.
And also, remember, when you actually buy them, we get them for real. We're talking about quart containers, what was called here a deli or a quart. Mm-hmm. They don't have them all over the country. I don't know why, because you can reuse them again and again. It seems like it's wasteful. It's not.
No.
When you buy soup from somebody, they will invariably poke a hole in the lid.
Yeah.
Which, just put your finger over that hole. It's not even going to leak that much. But like, I know why they poked a hole in the lid, but I wish they would not poke the hole.
Also, you can just order them. Like, you can just, they're like the deli containers, you can just get like a sleeve of like 15 and they last forever. The only thing you have to watch out for is that there's actually different, this is something I learned working in restaurants for too long, is that there's actually like a few different purveyors of quart containers, and they all have a little bit of a different fit.
Ooh.
So you have to look at the bottom. There's like a few different manufacturers. Sometimes they have a logo on it, sometimes they don't. So sometimes you can have a mismatch. And that drives me nuts. So I actually bought like a whole set from the same purveyor like all at once. So they
matching set.
Yeah. So you refuse to have matching coffee mugs, but quart containers, you're like, absolutely.
Right. I'll drop you guys some more quart container knowledge, because I am also an aficionado of the quart container. Quart containers weigh the standard quart container that we get. I think we buy Fast Cathy. I'm not sure. They weigh 32 grams.
Yep.
Maybe Summer's going to weigh one more, one less if you get a different brand. Quart containers without a lid weigh 32 grams. This is something you should commit to memory so that you just don't have to worry about thinking about it, right? When you're tearing stuff out on scales or if you need to figure something out, 32 grams. Second, quart containers, the containers themselves are made of polypropylene. Polypropylene can handle heat quite well, which is why it's fine to nuke in one. You can even put one into, but be careful it doesn't start floating, but you can put it into a water bath and heat it and heat around to like thaw that stuff out to pop it or whatever you're going to do. Polypropylene, great. Polypropylene, very, very bad at cold temperatures.
Yeah, they get really brittle.
Really brittle. So when you freeze a quart container, right, and you pull it out, you have to be very careful because if you set it down too hard, you'll crack the quart container. Now, if you set it down real hard or if you drop it, it'll shatter and there'll be little pieces of quart container all over your floor. But if you just hit it and crack it without shattering it, which can happen as it thaws out, you'll get a leak. I've had this happen to me more times than I care to think about. The other thing is the lid on a quart container is not made of polypropylene. The lid on a quart container is made of polyethylene. And polyethylene, right, while it's got good flexibility and compliance and fits on, makes a nice lid, is not okay with super high heat. So if you've ever noticed, if you put something into a quart container and nuke it, if you nuke it a little bit too long, like the lid will turn into a chef's hat and then eventually explode off the top of the quart container because you've expanded the gas. But the reason that it expands out is because and deforms is because it's made of polyethylene, which has a much lower surface temperature than polypropylene. Polyethylene, you're not even really supposed to boil it, the stuff that is, because not because it'll melt, but because it'll deform and become real kind of plasticky. Which is
why do they do that? So that it can seal over the edge of the bottom part?
I guess, or you know, maybe it's on purpose so that the first thing that blows off is the lid if somebody overheats it. I don't know. But, I mean, that's why, you know, for years people said that not to use Ziploc bags, which are polyethylene, to do reheat on sous vide. And they made it seem like that because the company that makes the Ziploc bags didn't want you to put it in boiling water. Because if you've ever had Ziploc bags into really hot water, when you pull it out, you're like, oh my God, this feels weak. This feels wrong, right? It's because it's approaching its service temperature. So you really want to keep those lids below around like 70 Celsius, 60, 70 Celsius in that range to have their full structural integrity. And that's why that happens. But
I like this term service temperature.
Service temperature?
Yeah. Very useful.
Yeah. I keep the other problem with quart containers is, and I've seen this a million times, is please dry your quart containers before you restack them.
Oh, God, please. Yes.
Please. And also, if you work in a restaurant like Sambar where everyone's going to be packing quart containers with chopped scallions, like try to segregate. Try to segregate your alliums from your grapefruit juice, especially something like grapefruit juice. Because like grape, for some reason, and I think I'm reading an advanced copy of Harold McGee's new book, which is, you know, when it comes out, we'll talk about. But like, I think there are some sulfury notes in grapefruit and like minor like kind of note. And so that when you have other sulfury notes like onions, it just really takes it in a wrong direction. You know what I mean? Like especially grapefruit juice, anything, but really like, we had so many liters of gin and juice, which is grapefruit juice for us, ruined by pouring them into scallion-tainted sambar quart containers. So buy a sleeve of quart containers, like John says, for yourself. Get the lids, right? Don't throw them away unless you crack them. As soon as you crack them, please throw them away. Nothing's worse than pouring a liquid into it and having it pour all over your counter, right? I also, John, you might not believe it, but I use or agree with this, but I also use them for storing my leftovers for food and whatnot because I think it's much more efficient. Yeah.
Me too.
So I also get the pint containers, and I have a couple of the 8 ounces around because it's very sad. And they all take the same lids if you get them from the same purveyor. It's sad for me to see a quarter full quart container in my fridge. Real sad.
Yeah, that's the restaurant life.
Yeah,
and drilled into you.
And if you've ever worked, also like here's more restaurant life. First of all, you should have a station in your kitchen with plastic wrap, a decent quality plastic wrap. I also have a bar sealer, not a vacuum sealer, a bar sealer to like reseal bags and tater chip things and flour and rice packages and whatnot, right? But keep a roll of blue tape and a Sharpie there.
Yep.
Right, and just put a piece of blue tape. It takes an extra second, but then you know when you put that in. So you're not, when did this go in? I don't know. What is it? Ba, ba, ba. Just label it and keep that stuff in the, like, resist the temptation to take that Sharpie and blue tape and put them elsewhere in your house. Keep them in your kitchen next to the plastic wrap, which is the classic place where you're going to be packaging everything to put back into your fridge. And remember my other piece of advice, which is if you wrap food in aluminum foil, just throw it away now. Right? Unless you label it with blue tape and you write what's on it, as soon as you put something in aluminum foil and put it in the freezer, you would have been better off just throwing it away now, because that's what happens. The reason I put things in quartz and clear plastic is because if you can't see it, unless you're a different kind of person than I am, you won't eat it. You know what I mean? What do you think about that, JDB?
Yeah, I'm trying to think what I use. I only use tin foil now when I color my hair.
Yes, I would believe that.
Yep. It looks really
nice. You do your own coloring job?
Yeah, I do now. Yeah.
And do you feel the quality is the same?
No, absolutely not. I did it yesterday, and now the hair that's like the ends of my hair, it's like I've been combing it, and it's like literally falling out because it's been bleached like 4 times. And if you go to a real place, they only will put the bleach on like the new parts. They use like a brush. It takes like 5 hours. It's like a huge pain in the ass. But if you just slather yourself in bleach and sit there with tinfoil on your head for like 45 minutes, like your hair will burn off. But, you know, it's pretty short, so I don't really care. I can just shave it if the worst thing happens.
A lot to unpack here.
So Booker had his hair dyed like straight green, and we paid the full price. This is before COVID. We paid the full price to get it done by someone with talent.
It's worth it.
Yeah,
but
well,
it's a lot.
She had this technique where she like put it in such a way. I don't know what she did because I don't understand how this works, but she did it in such a way that when it grew back, I mean, obviously you're going to see it, but it looked okay. She did some.
Yeah, what they do is they paint it sort of like in a gradient, so it like fades into the end. So it's not just like this sharp line when it grows in. So that's what they do. It's actually like sort of like they color your hair in a way that looks like it transitions back to your natural color.
See what I mean? Like,
it's good.
If you can pay for someone with the skill, pay for someone with the skill. Know what I mean?
Yeah, definitely.
Hey, John, can we talk about the haircut that I'm really pushing for you to get?
Oh, the Gregorian monk?
Yes.
Oh, no. Why?
The Friar Tuck? You're going to shave the top ball and leave it a little room?
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, why not?
Yeah, you know, you should do it.
Yeah.
Quarantine's the best time.
And if you do that, can you also get the line beard that runs from where you're?
I don't do facial hair. Sorry, I'm trying to get my facial hair removed, so like that's a deal breaker. Yeah, yeah.
Wow. How long does that take?
Lasers. I've gotten 4 treatments so far.
Oh my god.
Oh my god. So can you let it just grow where they haven't treated it? I would love.
No,
to
it,
see that.
It like they basically it's like the it, you have to do it like a bunch of times and it like. The hair grows in and the laser zaps the follicle. So it, like the hair itself heats up and then kills the follicle. And you have to do it a few times because their follicles aren't all active. So
it's not like today I do the upper left side.
No, they do the whole thing. It takes like 20 minutes.
Oh my God. I would have loved it if it was the other way.
That'd be cool.
And then you could just grow these patches.
Ooh. It'd be like half your face has facial hair and the other half doesn't.
Well, yes. But then if you were like committed to the mutton chops or something, you could just be like, I would like permanent mutton. I would like it to not grow in anywhere that's not mutton chops.
I think you can do that. You can request that.
Okay, so are there people, because everyone, like, it's the underbeard that is the biggest pain.
The neck is the worst. Well, I went in, and I'm like, can you just take the hair off my neck? And they're like, you might as well see your whole face. And I was like, sure.
So
yeah, they upsold me real hard.
Yeah.
So how much extra is it for the whole face as opposed
to the
insane. Neck?
That's why they were like, basically, you're here, you're already doing it, and it's an extra like 10 minutes like of just like, because they just go beep, 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 beep all over your face. And like the whole thing takes like maybe 15 minutes because your face is relatively small.
Does it make that noise?
It actually does, kind of. And it's like a little snap.
Ooh.
Yeah. It like hurts a little. Like the person who does it is like, you like this a little bit too much. And I'm like, I just want results. Like, come on, do it.
And does it work equally for, they can do it to any skin complexion?
I think it works better if you have the higher contrast between your skin and the color of your hair. So I have very pale skin and I have rather dark chestnut hair. So it works particularly well. But I think it's different. They use different frequencies of light depending on your skin color.
So are you going to get your hair lasered into a Friar Tuck?
Ooh, that's a commitment. Yes. Yep. No.
Sight unseen, permanent tuck.
Intense. Yeah, permatuck. I would like... Wow. I think we should take up a collection with the Cooking Issues crowd to get JDB with the permatuck. Like, that would be amazing. I would love to see that.
It's basically or just someone. male accelerated pattern baldness, yeah. Right? I mean,
no, but it looks different.
But it's intentional.
You want the edge. Very you want the sharp edge.
And it's a sharp edge, and it's real full all the way around. You know what I mean? Like, that's the thing. That's why it's different. It's like it's a different look.
Also, only a young the man can cut pull off bangs type thing. You know, like it's amazing.
It's definitely a young man's haircut. The full tuck. I would pay $100 to see Nastasia rock the tuck.
$100.
$100 does not seem like enough to make that happen.
It doesn't sound like a lot.
I'm saying Nastasia,
what would be the price to make that happen? I'm just curious.
I don't know. I guess a million.
$1 million. See, this is how we get into discuss. Nastasia and I get into so many arguments like this because she'll come up with a number that's just like so. Like, okay, we're not family we, show, wait, but like any disgusting thing, right? She'll ask me,
wait, what would be, and
I'm like, I don't know.
Me, but not
I don't
a
know, 30 grand. John. What?
Why is it a family show when you talk to me, but not a family show when John talks?
Technically, it's retroactively a family show for John. I have every utterance of a swear word time stamped, and it will not exist in the final thing.
No, what I'm saying is that like the actual subject matter is not appropriate.
I don't know what you're going to bring up. Well, I do, and let's not go there.
And
but
any number of unpleasant things, we're like, how much would it cost to get you to do blah, right?
Yeah.
And for me, my number's always like, what, Stas?
Way lower. Way.
Like way lower. And my thing is that like someday I hope that I don't want to do this because you don't want to walk up to someone who doesn't have money and offer them money to do something bad, right? That's that Robert Redford movie. But it's like I feel like, if someone was actually to offer that Nastasia's number would actually be lower, if someone actually showed up with a wheelbarrow of money, I don't think it would be $1 million. I think if someone showed up with a suitcase with 80 grand in it, you'd be like, yeah, I'll go tuck.
Well, the nice thing with the tuck is that I think you could basically cover, if you have long hair, you could cover the tuck with the remaining hair. And just put it in a ponytail.
Tuck length.
Well, you would have a ponytail at the bottom, so it's like a rat tail Friar Tuck situation.
It's not a Gallagher haircut. It's not Gallagher. It's Tuck.
Don't bring up Gallagher to me. Ugh, I hate him so much. And Mike loves putting on a Gallagher like clip on YouTube, and I hate it.
Whoa.
It's the worst.
Marital bliss ruined by Gallagher.
I feel compelled. We're not that far from the end of our time. And the chat is like awash in Jaspidi theories.
Okay, well, listen. Elysio wrote in on Instagram with, and this, by the way, thank you, because I was looking it up last week, and I think it was, so for those of you that didn't hear the Jaspidi story, we talked about it on our 10th anniversary episode. We talked about it before. It's the pastry that I've never gotten to eat. Everyone that planned the wedding is dead. I can't figure out. My stepfather doesn't know really what a Jaspidi is. And my mom, they were the ones that got married. I never got to taste it thanks to my crazy dead grandparents and the motorhome and the parrot and the two dogs. And what I didn't mention is that...
What are you talking about?
This is the Jaspidi story.
Go back in time one episode. You just got to listen to the last episode. That's
yeah, fine. One thing I'll say is that I've had to miss the Jaspidi at the wedding, right? That I've been hearing about for months, that this was the only pastry that you ever needed to taste. And when my grandparents made me leave the wedding early before it was over, who does that? Who makes you leave your own mom's wedding before your mom's wedding is over, right? Assuming that, you know, you're alive at your mom's wedding. And then we drove to make it back to my house in Mount Kisco and parked the motorhome in the driveway where, not then, but later on, it would live for 3 years, where my grandparents lived in my driveway, which is a true story. They didn't have the keys to the house, so I just had to sit in the driveway in that motorhome for like a day waiting for, you know, my mom and my stepfather to come give us the keys. Yeah. Anyway, Jaspidi. So Elysio wrote in, I guess it's Elysio, hi, Dave, just listening to the podcast and wondering if the pastry at your mother's wedding is Jaspidi. How do you pronounce this, Stas? You see this, Jaspidi?
I didn't share it with her. S-O-S-P-I-R-I.
I love that movie. I-R-I.
This is what I instantly heard. My parents are Italian and speak dialect, and a local bakery sells these. And S-O-S-P-I-R-I, Italian wedding pastry filled with a lemon thing. This has to be it. Before, the next best guess was Zeppoli de San Giuseppe, right? But this has to be it. I think you have solved it. I think this is the answer. So now I just have to find someone in New York who makes it.
Chef Joanna was in on the chat and said this. I was listening to the 10-year anniversary podcast and realized that you may not have seen my previous reply. Oh, it's the same person. Okay, yeah, it's your previous reply. Yeah, that's her theory. Perhaps bastardized the way that capicola becomes gabagool.
Oh my God!
Don't get me
what's our favorite Stas?
Calamari, right?
Yeah, yeah.
Calamod.
Well, yeah, that's my favorite. Like first of all, San Gennaro feast. Like one of the only good things about COVID is that didn't go on this year. Like that, I hate that feast.
Isn't it
so much?
It's in September, so I could still have time.
What?
It's in September, so I could still have time.
Anyway, like I hate it. I hate it.
There's another person with a Connecticut theory, though.
What's that?
And I mean, this one sounds better, I think. But here we go. Is it possible the Gispiti pastry was generic reference to a pastry from Giuseppina's Italian bakery in South Windsor, Connecticut?
I don't know, but no, this is more Boston, and I guarantee you that Arcangelo Adonisio, the butcher from Boston, did not go to South Windsor, Connecticut to get his pastries.
That sounds right.
But the... Now, I'm pretty sure that this is correct. Sospiri thing is correct. But San Gennaro's,
John DeBerry needs to run.
Oh, well, John, thank you for coming on. And go check out Drink What You Want, his new book. Can I run through a couple of questions or no? Because I have answers to all the questions that I have.
Questions for me?
No. These are just questions that you could weigh in on or not.
Yeah, no, John, you can go and it won't.
No, I'm getting kicked out of my house for the afternoon for some work. So,
yeah,
I believe that.
All right.
Well, anyway, all my love. Check out his book on fine book selling platforms. Do you have a particular place you prefer people buy it, or just Amazon?
Amazon's probably like my fourth choice. You can just go to like Penguin Random House, and they actually have like a whole smorgasbord of vendors where you can do like they'll help you find like independent bookstores near you. So just search for Drink What You Want, John DeBerry, and then it should pop up.
Yep,
so you have options.
John of DeBerry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Coming on. Yeah.
All right.
Before you go,
what?
Are you gone?
No.
Yes. So your daiquiri, your classic daiquiri, 2 3/4, 3/4. Do you actually do that, or do you shy the lime up when you're making it for yourself?
I do the lime up. Yeah.
Okay. And so I don't shy the lime up. I shy the sugar down.
Mm-hmm.
And also, like, older I get, the more I come closer to a half-half. Well, obviously for gin stuff, I'm half-half, not 3/4, 3/4. But even on the daiquiri, I shade the stuff down now. Like, are you changing you're a lot younger than I am, but do you change as you age or no?
No, I mean, I think I kind of like having the sugar bumping the lime up rather than putting the sugar down, because the sugar has a nice like texture to it, and then it gets the dilution, whereas it can just be a bit hot if you're lowering the proportion of non-rum ingredients in it. So I just like to keep the volume up.
Right, whereas your margarita recipe is considerably drier.
Right.
You prefer a drier margarita.
Yeah, I'd say that's true. And it's because it's got a lot more going on, you know, with like the Curacao or the triple sec or whatever you're using in the agave. So it just has a nicer, like to me, the balance is different. I feel like a daiquiri is just supposed to be chewier.
All right. Well, anyway, thank you so much for coming on. And Matt, do I have a second to rip through some of these questions?
If there's anything that's very time sensitive, do that. Save the rest for later.
This episode is brought to you by Dashable, an app created to help you find deals, discounts, and coupons for local businesses in New York City. Dashable will help you find the deals worth dashing for in a variety of categories, from food and drink to art, health, and pets. Support local and save money when you download Dashable today. That's D-A-S-H-I-B-L-E.
I'd like to see what Dave considers time sensitive with these.
Well, no, do they have
normally
a
party? Normally it's like holidays or parties or a wedding, et cetera, et cetera.
Got it.
John, do you remember any being specifically time sensitive?
No.
Dave Foster did send us a bottle of Idaho spring water in a Perrier thing. I did get a hold of it. It was delivered. But I wanted to wait until we were all together to taste it. Does that make sense? Stas, you want to taste it, right?
Yeah, we still have limoncello to taste, but I don't know when I'm ever going to see you.
We should do a socially distanced but all together thing. Would that even work?
What is thing?
What is thing?
Is thing recording?
Radio show. We're all
Yes. Of course.
So we could all talk into our own mics. It wouldn't get confusing. Or I guess we do it in the radio show. We do it in the studio.
Yeah, it probably would end up not being live. But yeah, we could do it. We could do it in Connecticut.
Yeah. I have a couple calls on pressure cooking. I'll get to Cess next time, I guess, because that's going to take a long time. Matt Hall writes in, I've heard Dave state a preference for non-venting pressure cookers. How do I tell if my pressure cooker is venting or non-venting? Thanks. If it goes or when it's using, it's venting. The Kuhn Recon only does that when you've really jacked the pressure higher than you are supposed to. Tyler Lynn wrote in about the HVD 857, says we actually bought the HVD waffle iron like you and even brought it through my brother-in-law. I saw you said you could swap it from 110 to 220. We bought it as a 110 and are actually interested in changing it now to 220. Do you have any idea how to do that? Also, your recipe is amazing. We've tried a few and yours is easily the best. Well, thank you, Tyler. You got to call the guy who you bought it from, who I will just refer to cryptically as Ray Waffles. Now, the problem with Ray Waffles is Ray Waffles, as we say in the trade, got the COVID. And he was kind of sick. I haven't spoken to him since, but my brother-in-law has. But get back in touch with Ray Waffles. He can do it for you. I hope he's okay. I haven't spoken to him since all that stuff went down. All right, so I guess the rest we should...
Yeah.
One more?
No.
You want me to talk popsicles? All right. I'm going to get to all your popsicle, backpack, vacuum machine, roto-vapping stuff next week, I guess. But next week, Nastasia is not going to be on. So who are we going to get to stand in for Nastasia?
There's an ice cream man, and John will be on.
Oh yeah, we're getting Milk Cult coming on. Next week will not be the next Flower Armageddon episode. We're trying to schedule that for later on this summer, correct, John?
Correct.
All right. And Nastasia, on our way out, have you had any interesting cooking experiences this week? Because I know that you've been trying to re-ramp your interest in cooking. And someone wrote in, actually, which I should have said this before I let you have the last word here. Someone said, and I can't find it, maybe John will remind me, someone said that along with Classics in the Field, we should do a whole thing on cooking for one and trying to keep interest up when you're cooking for one. But what do you got?
No, nothing this week. But this weekend I might have something cool.
Yeah. John, do you remember where that question came in from?
I think that was Devin Patel, the pasta troll.
Oh.
Yeah.
I'll read that then on the way out, and then we'll leave you guys thinking this. This is Devin, the pasta troll. I hope everyone is staying safe. I write to you because I want to make a request. Can there be a new segment on the show, like Classics in the Field, for cooking alone issues? I often wonder how much pasta sauce is the right amount to make for oneself, or how many days can leftovers stay in the fridge and still be non-toxic? And last but most important, is it okay to eat out of the pan you just cooked a meal in, including dump meals? One-stop pan, am I right? Or maybe tips for the budding home cook, like salt your tomato slices or slicing an onion with a butter knife for no tears. Much appreciated, Devin. Oh, Stas, before we go, so I think this is something that maybe you could take on. And I think it's a lot of it's also just maintaining interest when you're cooking for yourself, right?
Yeah. I mean, every day it's like, oh, I gotta cook dinner. But
do you eat? Do you eat directly out of the pan?
I'm having a very positive outlook on it now.
I like that.
Can't wait for dinner.
I like that. Well, because that's going to be helpful to make you feel better all around, isn't it? If you feel better about like your daily routine, isn't that make it better at all?
Yes.
Do you eat right out of the pan?
No.
What? That doesn't seem like a Nastasia thing. No.
Well, I'm just asking. This is the question. One of the things Devin wanted to know. So you don't eat directly out of the pan.
No. To me, eating directly out of the pan is one of the big payoffs of cooking for one.
Wow. Okay. This is a different mental attitude. Nastasia, Matt, a little bit more of an adult. No. Likes to eat off of a plate.
It's really hot.
Yeah, and the carryover heat's going to mess up what you've got in the pan.
Wow.
Yeah.
And also then, like, do you have to stand? Like, where are you sitting with this? Are you standing over the stove eating?
Yeah, I probably didn't move very far. And the carryover heat screwing up the, like, what I've done is exactly the kind of thing I don't care about when I'm cooking for myself.
It's true. And if you just eat it quickly enough, it doesn't matter.
So maybe we'll end with this Nastasia story, see if she remembers this. But I was on the phone with her. And she almost punched herself in the face because she becomes so debased cooking by herself that she made one of the biggest fundamental prep errors ever. And she was like, what am I, a useless rookie? I should jump into the freaking sound. Do you remember what you did, Stas?
Yeah, I cut the onion before I cut the strawberries.
Oh, on the same board, right?
Yeah.
People. And like you, what I love about, and this is why Nastasia and I can work together, because instantly she's like, why am I breathing? This is ridiculous.
Yes. No, well, I had people coming over, so it was like major blunder.
Yeah. Well, it's probably what saved you. Like if you didn't have people coming over.
True.
Are your boards wood or plastic?
Right, wood.
Do you do the same thing I do? I stick it in the sink and I sit there and I scrub it down and then I put my nose right against it and scrub and nose. It takes so long to get that onion out.
No, I don't do that. I don't do that.
Yeah. And remember, if you use a relatively porous knife, like a carbon steel knife, and you make the mistake of cutting onions, not only will you get that weird color on the onions, but that onion flavor will stay on your knife for a good long time. Am I right? Anyway. Yes. So we'll see you next week, but not with Nastasia. Nastasia will come back in 2 weeks with her cooking for one extravaganza. You want to just take care of that segment? You want to be the cooking for one person?
Can I think about it since this is the first time I've heard of it, or should I?
Of course you can think about it.
Okay.
All right. But, you know, we have 2 weeks, so if you want to do it, we'll do it. Okay. If you don't want to do it, we won't do it.
Okay.
All right. Cooking Issues. Cooking Issues is powered by Simplecast. Thanks for listening to Heritage Radio Network, food radio supported by you. For our freshest content, subscribe to our newsletter. Enter your email at the bottom of our website, heritageradionetwork.org. Connect with us on Instagram and Twitter at @heritage_radio. You can also find us at facebook.com/heritageradionetwork. Heritage Radio Network is a nonprofit organization driving conversations to make the world a better, fairer, more delicious place. And we couldn't do it without support from listeners like you. Want to be a part of the food world's most innovative community? Subscribe to the shows you like, tell your friends, and please join the HRN family by becoming a member. Just click on the beating heart at the top right of our homepage. Thanks for listening.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway, and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Awele, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries. Like, why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode? Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.